Well, didn't get you out of fellowship.
Nothing possibly could.
A few announcements before we begin. We would like to get a rotating schedule set up for setting up and breaking down Bible class, where we each do, I don't know, whatever, every third month, every fourth month, whatever works out. So if you are interested in applying in that area, see Bill, and we'll try to set up a schedule where it's always the same, where we don't have to make this announcement in an ongoing fashion. Secondly, we are considering, this is just in the thinking stages, so don't panic yet, the possibility, should grace provide and we have the time and it all works out, of a fifth class, Bible class on Tuesday. Well, I want to tell you about it now so you can think about it, pray about it. One of the considerations would be how many people's niche would permit it. If half the congregation can't attend, we're not going to add another Bible class. if they could, and you're interested, again, certainly pray about it. And any feedback, I'd be interested in hearing, so please feel free to weigh in. Give it some thought. This would be down the road. This is not anything immediate. But we would like to maximize as much as we can. Again, there are a number of factors that would go into making this decision, one of which would be this, the level of support, which, by the way, has been very high, and I'm very appreciative for the level of application that I see financially. So that's one factor, but there are other factors, schedules, you know, what we can do realistically, if they would charge us more here in terms of rent, that would be a factor we'd have to consider. So it's just in the thinking stages at this point, but we'd like you to think about it and pray about it and give it your consideration. And lastly, and this is only simply a request, if a bunch of you know that you're planning time off at the same time, if you'd let me know, it would be great. You don't have to, it's not an imperative or anything, but if half the class is going to be gone, I know how difficult it is to make up classes as it is. I'd just as soon wait till, you know, most of the people are here. So I'm not going to cancel if one or two are gone, obviously. But if 50% are gone, that's a different ballgame. So it's not, an imperative, but just to kind of keep us apprised. You don't even have to let me know. I mean, you can let Bill know or whatever, just so somebody has some idea, oh, yeah, I realize, you know, half the people are going to be gone. So those are the announcements for today. Let's get make sure you're in fellowship then and get back to the text here. We're dealing with verses 10 through 12. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. And I think you could actually not do any injustice to this by translating, he will never be satisfied with money. It's not just he's not going to be satisfied occasionally, he'll never be satisfied with it. Nor he who loves abundance will be satisfied with its income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage of their owners except to look on? They can just simply observe this as their goods are consumed by other people. The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. But the satiety, the fullness of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. His money, his details, his position in life and all that. Again, I don't think it's focusing on his stomach so much as he's using the word, again, in terms of his prosperity. We might even translate, the prosperity of the rich man doesn't allow him to sleep. Why? Because he's worried about what's going to happen to him, as people tend to do. So 6 is the one we wrapped up on here. The subject of those that love money is addressed in a number of passages, all of which indicate that it is not a profitable way to live your life. We closed with, let your character be free from the love of money. 7, the person that makes the acquisition of wealth the highest goal of his life will find that he has provided himself a never-ending task. If you want to be on a treadmill, this is the way to do it. And at the end of the day, after, no matter how long you're on the treadmill, guess where you are? Same place you started. And that is the way of people that pursue the details. 8, no matter how much one accumulates, pardon me, there is always the possibility of accumulating more. The desire to get more often comes to those, often comes to consume those rather that pursue it. And again, it boils down to it's never enough for some people. It's just a constant onward and upward mentality. And this is designed, I think all these teachings on money and all that are designed to take a lot of the wear and tear off of you in life that you're going to put yourself through if you don't rightly orient to this huge factor of life, which is money and the details. And getting them and getting more, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's ongoing. 9, however, all the money in the world will not satisfy the human heart. The person with this priority will find that he is often discontented. That's another thing that you tend to see in these types of people. They're never really content. They're always trying to get ahead. They're always trying to make the next deal. They're always trying to climb the social ladder. They're always trying to do these things. And no matter how high you get, there's always somebody higher. Again, even if you succeed in all this, you become a success here and locally, say Sarasota, and your name's in the society column all the time, and you're at all the fundraisers, and you do this, and you do that, and everybody knows who you are. What difference does it make? Is God any more impressed with that person than he is with you right now? My response is no, he's not. 9, the verb, that should be, that's not a sheen there, I realize that, it's savea. Is normally used of being satisfied by nourishment, although the word is used to denote fullness in other areas of life. For instance, in 1 Chronicles 23:1, so I, you know, and I see it here locally. Some of you probably watch the local news on Channel 7, and Linda Carson's out there telling us who the movers and the shakers are and what's going on and how we need to live. And I'm just like, oh, God. First, she's obnoxious in the first place. And second, I don't care about that stuff. It just doesn't matter. I suppose you got to have these kind of people, though, I guess. I wonder how much of this will really be going on in the millennium. Probably not a lot of it. I think there's going to be one celebrity there. 1 Chronicles 23:1. Now when David reached old age, now that here, that's, it's not translated the way they translate in English. He was full of years is the idea of it, full of days. So again, it denotes abundance in other areas here in terms of time than it does financial. Also Psalm 104:13, it's used there. He waters the mountains from his upper chambers. Here God bestowing grace upon the world in terms of rain. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of his works. That's the word satisfied there. That's our word. Filled with God's grace and all that that provides. Also, verse 16, the trees of the Lord drink their fill. Here, trees taking nourishment from the ground, obviously. They are satisfied. They have enough to live. And they're full. And then verse 28, that you give to them, they gather it up. You open your hand, they are satisfied with good. Again, all that God can provide for people in terms of both emotional, physical satisfaction, all these things, every area of life. So 11, in that regard, money will not satisfy the hunger of humans for satisfaction or contentment. This is something you cannot buy. This is something you cannot acquire with money. Money has nothing to do with it. If you learn to be happy with little, you can be happy with much. But God will probably, my experience has been personally, what I've observed in the lives of people. Now some people, God blesses them, we might say, right out of the chute. They have a certain measure of prosperity and all of that that other people don't have. I believe that in the Hebrews passage there, God becomes a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And that implies some time. That implies, a certain length of testing and all that that goes with that. Unspoken there, but my experience has been, and what I've seen in the lives of people, if you can't be happy where you are now, you can't be happy. You say, well, I could be happy if I were wherever. Pick a place. So, greatest place you think on planet Earth. And you were there. Guess what's going to happen? You'd be happy for whatever, however long, a few days, few weeks, few months. And then you all of a sudden you're going to realize, oh God, my STA is with me. And then the happiness is going to flee. And you'll get tired of it. I remember, when we first moved down here, we were all excited. We were at the beach every weekend, happy, happy, happy. Not so much now. Never. I can't remember the last time I was at the beach. Is it pretty out there? Is it wonderful? People pay god-awful amounts of money to come here just to be able to go out there and walk on the beach and gather up shells. And, you know, but I can see it every day if I wanted to, I suppose. But that's not, is that going to make you happy? No, it doesn't. So pick the greatest place on the planet you could be. And if it weren't for the standard of living, this might very well be it, or the cost of living. But I'd be happy there. No, pick amount of money. How much money would it take to make you happy? If I had X amount of money in the bank, I'd be happy. No, you wouldn't. If I had this, if I had that, if this thing changed, that thing changed, I'd be happy. You're either happy or you're not. And you're either oriented to God or you're not. So money cannot buy this. The details cannot buy this. 12, although the verb savia is not repeated in the second portion of the verse, it is to be understood as governing the second phrase as well. And that is, he will not be satisfied, he who loves abundance will not be satisfied with its income. That's the word there. 13, the second portion of the verse emphasizes the unrest that accompanies the pursuit of more and more profit. 14, the noun kamon, kamon, is most often used of an abundance of people, a multitude, and the accompanying tumult that often exists with a large group. If you've ever tried, one of the things, if you really want an exercise in futility, get a group of about 20 people here on vacation and try to shepherd them in any direction. Try to get them all to do the same thing at the same time, and you will end up just putting a gun to your head. And if the larger the crowd, the worse the tumult. So the idea here is that there's a certain amount of unrest that comes with all this. I've given up on it. When people are here on vacation, I just say, whatever. That's my new motto, whatever. What time you going to be there? Whatever. Because I guarantee you, no matter what time you set, there'll be somebody late. They won't be there on time. So you just have to learn to deal with that. It drove me crazy the first 5 years or so, or 10 I was down here. And then I finally just said, you know, I realize I'm just wearing myself out. And these people are on vacation. They don't care. So, again, there's a tumult that exists. When you get a large group together, the larger the group, the more noise, the more rowdiness, the more disorganization at a certain level. So 15, in that regard, it emphasizes the noise, commotion, unrest, and turbulence one must endure in order to become a success in the financial realm. And people go at it all the time. You know, I watch them on TV, you know, they act like it's a big deal. They close the stock market, they ring the bell, and they're all standing there clapping like a bunch of idiots. Why? Because this is their life. They pursue this. Their life rises and sets with the stock market. And if you're going to watch that thing every day, let me tell you, you're going to be off balance half the time. One of the few things that I ever heard from one person that was actually correct and true was that the stock market functions on two factors, fear and greed. Well, that makes it pretty volatile, to say the least. So how are you going to get ahead in life? How much work do you have to do to get ahead in life? And then how does it all work out for you? That becomes another whole issue in all this is, well, how does it all work out? Even if you go to all the trouble and you do go through all the gyrations to get ahead, and let's say you succeed, how much work is it? How much does it just wear you out? And that's the whole point. You don't have to be worn out like that. Proper orientation to money and the details of life and living on a short leash is very healthy. That doesn't mean you have to deny yourself everything. But in certain cases, you may have to deny yourself a lot of things. So what? You've got no guarantee. I mean, all this is grace anyway. God doesn't say, I owe you this person such and such. I don't get up every morning and think, okay, you owe me today, God. It's mine. I deserve it. I remember when I was a kid, there was this song called The World Owes Me a Living. The world doesn't owe you anything. God doesn't owe you anything. If he gives it to you, it's grace. And so you have to orient to that, and you have to be willing to humble yourself. And at a certain level, I was mostly flat broke for the bigger portion of 15 years. So what? Was I unhappy? No. No. Money doesn't make you happy, even if you have money. Then you got to watch it and worry about it. Well, let's not worry about it. Just pray what the psalmist prayed. Give me enough. Or Proverbs, I think it was. Give me enough. Give me my portion. Give me enough so I don't go out and steal and blaspheme your name. And give me my portion so, and I don't need too much, lest I forget about you. See, some people, they get ahead in life and they forget about God. I've seen people, literally over the years, I've seen people that were poor, they've struggled, it was tough and it was hard times, and they were in there and they hung in with doctrine, they applied, they got some wealth, some prosperity, and they didn't need all that anymore. They had more important stuff to do. So, and by the way, and then to pursue all this out there in the cosmos and all that, how many times do you have to violate separation and all that to get ahead? How many people do you have to socialize with and hobnob and schmooze that aren't even worth your time spiritually? To me, that's not satisfying at all. I've been to some of these things, you know, that weren't fundraisers, but they were sort of society-type things. People that thought they were, you know. And there's various echelons of that, even. You know, you got the people down here in society, then you got the group above that, then you got the group above that, then you got the group that lives up there in the penthouse on the bayfront. And somebody parks their car, somebody pays their bills, somebody does this, somebody does that. They just live the high life, we might say. They're invited to everything. Why? Because they're big givers. You can be counted on for a donation. So you even have that, you know. And I've been to some of these, you know, I tended to, you know, I was only invited to the lower ones, trust me. I'd see these people, and they thought they were really something. I wasn't impressed. I just sat there and observed them and watched. Okay. Oh, this is great. Fancy dinner. Fancy drinks. Okay. And these people really thought they were something. I thought these people up here would look down on them so bad it wouldn't even be funny. But they think they're something. They live in this little world where they're, you know, kind of mucky mucks, I guess. But there's higher mucky mucks. And then there's higher mucky mucks over those, we might say, from the previous verse. So society's like that, and how much of this do you want to deal with? I don't care for it myself. I've never found it sad. I've done it a few times. Not because I pursued it. It was dropped in my lap. I don't assume that just because I did it, I was, you know, pursuing it. It was dropped in my lap. I did it a few times. It wasn't satisfying. Well, 16, however, all the energy one must expend to produce an abundance will not cause him to be satisfied with his accumulation. 17, the noun tavua, income, refers most often to the produce of the field. Poetic and prophetic literature extend the meaning to the fruit or result of something, which is, you know, one way of looking at a crop, at a harvest. It's the result of planting and all the hard work. 18, Koheleth again labels this pursuit of money, produce, and the things it can buy as another form of transient vanity that does not satisfy the human condition. And I think, bottom line, I think for most of us, all of us, I assume here, who are positive, at the end of the day, you want God to be happy with you. You want to be happy with God. And that should pretty much be the end of it. And if you have that at the end of the day, you know, let's hope your bills are paid. That'd be nice. That's enough. But if people pursue more and more and more, at the end of the day, they're just worn out from it. And there's another one, I believe it's in Psalms, I'm not sure, but there's one that says, God gives to his beloved even in his sleep. So if God loves you, you can be asleep, he can be blessing you. You say, what? Really? Yeah, really. So people go out there and work hard, and some people lay home and sleep. I mean, I'm advocating laziness. I'm talking about your normal night of sleep that we all have to have. So again, this doesn't satisfy. No matter how much you do for people, no matter how much you extend yourself, no matter how much you try, at the end of the day, it's not going to satisfy you. You won't. You won't find that it's going to... You're either satisfied and contented and happy, or you're not. And that comes from within. That doesn't come from pursuit of things or external forces. That comes from doctrine in the soul. So 19 in verse 11, he moves on to note that the accumulation of money and the details of life results in an increasing number of people that will consume them. And I'm sorry to say, but I've met people that they simply are friends with people sometimes. They simply pursue this person because they've got money and because they can do things for them. If that's going to be the basis of our friendship, well, what I'd like to say, I'm not going to say right now. But no, thanks. That I've never pursued people. I've never been friends with somebody because of what they could do for me. That is, to me, just gross. I'd have a lot to say on that, but I've got to use public language here. And that is just, to me, that is just obnoxious. Oh, so-and-so can do something for me, so I'm going to buddy up to him. No way. I would just as soon be with the person that can't do anything for me. At least I know they're not going to try to take advantage of me. You know, at least I know I'm not trying to take advantage of them. And I've had people who've done nice things for me, don't get me wrong. And I've had people who've never lifted a finger for me. I try not to treat them any differently. That is the goal. So, again, you become a little successful. You get a little money. You'll find out there'll be a leech that'll come and sponge off of you. That, at the bare minimum, you'll find that you'll run across this in life. And there'll be the hangers-on. You get a little bit of celebrity, let's say. And there'll be the hangers-on. And there'll be people that want to be around you. And ultimately, if you get really big and rich and famous, you're going to have to start paying them to be around you. God help you. You're going to have to pay people to be around you, to watch your money, to watch your car, to drive, to do this, to do that. I don't know. I can certainly see the advantage of the simple life. And Solomon, of course, had done all this to the maximum. And I think he sees the advantage of the simple life. I think he sees that none of this satisfies. None of this, the celebrity. And he was known worldwide, as we know. He was the biggest celebrity of his day. I mean, every year he was on People magazine, as it were. World's most popular man, Solomon. Every year. And so, again, people, what did it cost him to live? I mean, he talks about his entourage and what it cost. He doesn't, but in one of the books, the Hebrew books of the Old Testament, it talks about what he spent in a day just to feed the people that were around him. I mean, he didn't eat all that. So again, you've got people that are going to consume them. They're going to want to be around you. You got money. And who knows if they actually like you or care about you. But they only want to be around because of what you can do for them. Well, I don't. That to me is just gross again. Very gross. 20. Well, some have suggested that this refers to the creditors with whom the prosperous man must deal. While others see this increased number dealing with the entourage that becomes necessary to manage the prosperity. Well, 21, it makes little difference which group is in view. It may be a little of both. I would tend to lean towards the entourage type of thing, that you got the hangers-on, the people that want to be around, that are going to consume your wealth for you. And obviously, he's got to deal with creditors and all that other stuff. I mean, if he's got money, he's going to be spending it. He'll have bills to pay. The end result is that the person that accumulates significant prosperity will simply see much of it pass through his hand to others. And that's why you better hold your wealth like this, because it's going through them, whether you hold it like this. Or you can grab it and hold it closed, but the wealth will still manage to trickle out somehow. It's like trying to hold water, or shall we say the wind, as Solomon would put it. It's like trying to catch the wind. So, again, it's going to pass through his hands, goes to other people. 22, increased possessions will require many people to watch over the wealth and make certain that it continues to yield dividends. 23, this would include slaves that must be fed and housed, employees that must be paid, and the usual number of people that seek to take advantage of the prosperity of others. And, again, to me, that's odious. I've never done that, and I've seen people do it, and I didn't care for it. They're going to suck up to people because of what they can do for them. That is just not good. I got a lot to say on that one. But 24, it is a well-known fact that those with a significant amount of prosperity will attract those that simply want to consume that prosperity. You may have seen it in your life. God blesses you, you get a little ahead, and there's somebody there to sponge off of you. Somebody there, a leech. The leech has two daughters, Give and Give. That's their names. Proverbs 14:20. The poor is hated even by his neighbor. But those who love the rich are many. Well, of course. The rich are way more popular. They can do things. They pick up the tab when you go out to eat. I remember back in the 80s when I was working at the shoe store there in Oklahoma City. We ran into a significant amount of prosperity. God blessed us. And we worked hard, don't get it wrong. It wasn't like we didn't work for it. But inevitably it became known that, you know, you show up there after work, it's free drinks and free dinner. And you'd be surprised how many people started showing up. And I'm not saying they all had bad motives or bad attitudes about it, but I'm just saying it became a significant factor. And I saw it, and I thought, huh. Well, where were these people when we were poor? Didn't they like us then? Well, not so much. It's easier to like you if you got money, right? No, not at all. Proverbs 19, 4 and 6 also. So I've seen this in life. I've observed it. And then you find out later on, of course, you find out who your friends really are. You find out who'll stand by you when times are tough. You find out when the chips are down, who's going to be there. And it's not these hangers-on. It's not these leeches and these sponges. Wealth adds many friends, but a poor man is separated from his friend. Verse 6, and many will seek the favor of a generous man, and every man is a friend to him who gives gifts. Now, I hope, I'm sure at this point, none of you here would do this. But if you thought, well, if I just suck up to Ron, he'll give me a really nice Christmas present. I'm not going to. I just put your mind at ease. But I don't think any of you would do that. But there are people like that. And that's what this is decrying. That God, this is a horrible thing. There are people that are just going to, they're there nothing more than to consume your wealth. And by the way, don't get me wrong. It's not that I don't appreciate you. But I'm not buying you a Christmas present. Just want to tell you straight out. And don't buy me one either. I don't want one, necessarily. But I have a list if you're in. Kidding. We were talking yesterday after a board meeting. I said, you know, that's one of the things is when you're small, we used to, when we first started down here, it was a small group. We'd get together, exchange presents. All that. Well, as the group grew, it got to be oppressive to me. I didn't care for it. I didn't want to do it anymore. But then, you know, they call you things like Scrooge, and you're hearing the constant bah humbug. And it's not that I don't appreciate presents or like people or want to give presents. It's that I just, I don't know, just doesn't do anything for me. So I'm deadly serious. I was actually kidding. I don't want presents. So don't buy me anything for Christmas. You'll feel like you're some people feel this obligation to do stuff for people. Don't feel obligated. That's another thing. Even if you got prosperity, don't feel obligated. Pray about it. Do what you want to do. Nice cruise would be nice, but kidding again. My wife wouldn't go on a cruise, so you can forget about that one. 25, the noun tov here, good, is used with a definite article to signify every good or desirable thing, which would encompass the various forms of wealth mentioned in verse 10. 26, Koheleth then poses a rhetorical question that is designed to demonstrate the futility of great prosperity. As he asks, what form of success is this, really? I mean, this is success by the world standard, but what kind of success is it, really? Number one, the prosperous person is simply going to see a lot of wealth pass through his hands. That's all he's going to see. 27, the implied answer is that the owners of prosperity do not really get to enjoy the full fruit of their acquisitions. And 28, as Barton has stated, one can really enjoy but a limited amount of wealth. He who has more has only the pleasure of seeing others consume it. Now, do I enjoy doing nice things for people? Sure. And I think most normal believers do. And there's a certain pleasure that exists in that. I've got a particular friend, and he likes to pour very nice, expensive wines for me when I visit him. Am I for that? Yeah. But that's not why we're friends. That's not the basis of our friendship. And so there's a certain amount of pleasure that comes from that, of providing things for other people to enjoy. But one of the things I've observed is even if you provide people stuff to enjoy, they don't always end up enjoying it. They don't always end up being satisfied by it. And in some cases, if you provide a taker with more stuff, all they do is become a bigger taker. So I say, you know, I think Solomon would say, use your wealth wisely. Whatever prosperity you have, use it wisely. Pray about it. Think about it. And watch out if people are trying to take advantage of you. And be smart about it. And if people want to be friends with you because of what you can do for them, you don't need them. If they're not your friend anyway, let's say you quit doing for them whatever it is. And then they disappear. Well, you're going to find out that they weren't your friends anyway. Not at all. So 29, some interpreters have concluded that the last part of the verse refers to the owners watching over their wealth. However, the more logical sense is that they simply look on while others consume their prosperity. And that is the last part there, is what is the advantage of the owners in verse 11 to look on, except to look on. That's all they can do is observe this at a certain level. The great success for the owners is to watch others consume the fruit of their labors, knowing that they can do nothing about it. The accumulation of wealth carries this frustration with it. And if you ever get very wealthy, you'll find that this is going to be true. And, you know, there's two kinds of people. You know, there's those people that act like they're always, you know, poor dog in it. Oh, I don't have nothing. I never have anything. God's never blessed me. Oh, blah, blah, blah. And they try to hide their wealth, even though they're doing quite well, thank you very much. That person, to me, is a turnoff also. They're not being honest. I mean, you don't have to run around and flaunt your wealth on the one hand. But if God's blessed you, you know, don't tell me he hasn't. That impugns God, for one thing. Again, if you do get some wealth, though, you're going to find out there's a certain frustration that goes with it. And maybe God keeps some of us from being wealthy because he wants us to be happy. He doesn't want us to have to endure all these frustrations. So, again, how you deal with your wealth, and we have more revelation on this in the New Testament, obviously, there's the SG3 factor of how you deal with your wealth. That Solomon doesn't mention. Of course, Solomon, I don't know that he knew about the doctrine of SG3 per se. I assume he thought God would reward the righteous, but I don't know that he could have articulated everything we know about it. But the idea here is, you know, if you're going to use your wealth, use it for God's plan. Use it appropriately. And that's the whole purpose of grace giving, obviously, is to do that. For you to make your own decisions, pray about it, without fear, without coercion, without guilt, to know that you're absolutely free to do anything you want to do. And what I've seen over the years is, again, the Bible would validate this, is that the generous person is blessed by God. That's just a fact. It's just true enough. And I've seen it. I've seen it in my own life. God blesses me. But I've also seen in my own life, back when I was younger, I recognize that I was younger both spiritually and physically, that the tightwad approach really doesn't get you ahead in life. And it's not that satisfying either. So that doesn't work. So 31 here, Koheleth offers another observation on those that accumulate wealth by contrasting the rich man with the common laborer. 32, although some have asserted that the laborer in view is the common slave, the term for slave is not used. And the participle is to be understood as one that performs manual labor for his living. So 33, the more healthy outdoor lifestyle of the less wealthy peasant provides something that money cannot buy. In fact, an abundance of money often destroys the blessing of manual labor. And that's the whole point. There's a certain benefit from manual labor that just exists in hard work. And people that look down on people that work outside or all that, you know, well, they're missing the boat at a certain level. And as I've taught repeatedly, there is no dishonorable labor. There's just people who think they're too good to do it. Any labor is honorable in itself. I mean, assume it's not illegal, obviously, but I'm talking about normal manual labor. And again, some people, you know, I wouldn't want to be a trash man. I'll never work. I've heard this statement out of people, even people down here over the years. I've heard, I'd never do that. That's just stupid. You don't know what you'll do, and you don't know where God can put you. And if you've got that arrogant attitude, you don't know what he might humble you to do. And so I would advise against that very strongly. I don't believe that there's any, you know, I don't look down, I don't go to McDonald's and hold my nose while I'm going through the drive-thru. Oh, you work at McDonald's. Well, I might hold my nose, but it's not because of that. And I don't look at the trash man and say, oh, you're a trash man. Or the guy that works on your car, or whatever other manual labor you have to have. The guy that works in your yard. Oh, you're just a yard man. Well, please. There's no dishonorable labor. Again, there's just people who think they're too good to do it. So the idea here is that there's a certain blessing in manual labor, in hard work. And obviously you can't do it forever. You have to be 50, 60, 70 years old. You can't be out doing manual labor, most likely. There become physical factors that you have to take into this. But I think Solomon's talking about the norm. Say we're dealing with two 30-year-old people. And one man works hard for a living, the other man's wealthy, and he doesn't have to do anything. And the fact is, the fatigue here, point 34, produced by a day of physical exertion causes the worker to fall asleep, more easily fall asleep, and reap the benefits of a good night's sleep. 35, his more wealthy counterpart, who often has others perform the physical demands of his niche, will find that sleep flees from him. 36, although some, like the New American Standard, have understood the term sava to refer to the full stomach, the term is more general and simply denotes an abundance, Genesis 41:29. So this is one of the few times, I mean, there's a few, but again, that's why I use the New American Standard. It doesn't have to be largely corrected, but still there are places it needs to be. And I think they've missed the point here with the full stomach issue. I think it's his fullness in general, his abundance, his prosperity. Genesis 41:29, it's used there. Behold, 7 years of great abundance are coming in all the land of Egypt. This is the prophecy, again, the dream that Pharaoh had, which Joseph interpreted. In which he had this dream twice. And by the way, when dreams are repeated in Scripture, the point is that it's the fact that it's repeated means that it's sure and that it's going to happen quickly. So Genesis 41:29, there it's translated by great abundance, obviously not fullness of stomach, but it's a great prosperity. Proverbs 3:10 also is used there. Here, so your barns will be filled with plenty. This is the command, verse 9, honor the Lord from your wealth. Put God's plan first. And we teach that too. That's the principle of grace giving, that your financial priority first is to God's plan. And then God has to pursue you with whatever wealth he wants to pursue you with. So honor the Lord from your wealth in the first of all your produce. Not at the end of the deal, you write down your priorities. Got to pay the house, the car, you got your bills. And then down at the bottom, oh, local church. Should be the other way around. Local church should be at the top. Then all the other things fall into place. So your barns will be filled with plenty, and your vats will overflow with new wine. So if you want prosperity, the quickest way to get it is to give, which is strange. And I guess I know the fundies have abused the daylights out of this, and they've wrecked it. But the fact is, for us to teach otherwise is doing believers a disservice. I've heard over the years, well, he talks about money because it favors him. Well, I teach doctrines that don't favor me, too. And it only favors me to the extent that God wants it to. I can talk about money all day, every day in the pulpit. And that wouldn't make you give any more, would it? In fact, it might turn you off to the whole idea. So we have to deal with it for what it is here, that God blesses people. And that blessing may take time, may take years. Are you in it for the long haul? Are you in this to get your crown and get to complete your course and finish your race honorably before God? Or is some little thing, whatever it is, as we saw in the parables there, the parable of the sower, for instance, how many things trip people up? And one of the big things is money and the details of life trip people up. Persecution trips people up. Some people really lose faith in God and his plan. And they give up. Well, God's plan's moving on with or without you, but the reality is that we have to deal with these things as they are here in the Scripture. So 37, while the lack of ability to sleep may come from overindulging at the dinner table, it more likely stems from the anxiety of the wealthy over maintaining their abundance. I think that's the bigger issue here, is that they're busy trying to maintain that abundance. They're worried about it. What's happening in the money? Laying awake at night worrying about what's happening in China. In the Japanese stock market. I don't worry about it. And again, at a certain level, some prosperity is, it just creates more trouble, more tension, more turmoil in your life. If you let it. That's the whole point. If you let it. If you get consumed by it, you start getting focused on it. So 38, if the laborer is able to eat much and enjoy pleasant, refreshing sleep, Why could the wealthy not eat much and sleep well also? And the text here attributes it to his abundance. That's the whole point. Is that it's not just that he's full in the stomach, because the poor guy can go out there and eat a big meal and still sleep fine, it says, because he's worked all day. He doesn't have all this worry attending him that the rich guy has of how to manage it, how to get ahead. And I think probably all of us have learned by now in life that when we try to get ahead, it just creates more headaches in life. And it can create some real big headaches. And this type of teaching is designed to spare you that. So, 39, the answer is his mental preoccupation with his wealth, which follows him into the night and disrupts his sleep with concerns over his projects, business deals, how to amass more, how to get the best interest rate, how to do this, how to do that. And we're not, again, denigrating logical planning, thinking ahead, being a good steward. We're all for that. What we're talking about is the person that this becomes the focal point of their life. This is their great thing in life that they've pursued. They've achieved it at a certain level, maybe. But are they happy about it? Has it made their life better? I guess that's one of them. But another big question with wealth, how much would you have to get to make your life better? And Jesus is very clear on this. A man's wealth does not consist of the money and the details. A man's life is way bigger than this. You hear people, and I've been attuned to it more lately because maybe it's doing this book and thinking about life and what life is. But I hear it in songs and I hear it on certain places. People will talk about life. Well, what is life? And what does it mean? And what's it all about? And all that. And they don't really ever deal with that, but I hear people talking about it. And every time I hear it, I'm kind of attuned to it at this point in my life. And I think, do they even know what they're talking about? What do they mean by the word life? I mean, do they just mean being alive? I mean, the dog's alive. Animals are alive. Slug is alive. But is that life? Is that the kind of life we're talking about? We're talking, and again, I think Jesus was talking about a man's life consists of the whole of who he is and all that's involved in that. And it's not all about money, he said. It's not about his possessions. And so, again, some people you see, one of the things that's going to come across here, we're going to get it, I think. We've seen already, back in chapter 2, at the end of it, who can eat and drink and have enjoyment without him? How are you really going to effectively live apart from God? I mean, have life. Or anything that you would constitute a real satisfying existence. And we get this. And then here at the end of the chapter, we're going to get it. We're going to see two different kinds of people. We're going to see one man at the end of chapter 5 who's going to be contrasted with a different kind of man at the end, the beginning of chapter 6. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward, rejoice in his labor. It's a gift of God. And he will not often consider the years of his life because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. You have the happy, contented person that God's blessing. And then there's another evil I've seen, verse 2 of next chapter, a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor. Now God's blessed him too, at least overtly, with the money and the details of life. So that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God has not empowered him to eat from them. So in other words, you could have it all and still not be happy. You could have it all and God might not, he could jam it in so many ways. Now why can't he eat from them? Well, he says a foreigner enjoys them, but I can give you a bunch of other reasons too. Well, maybe he can't eat because his digestion's bad. Maybe he can't eat because he has some physical malady. Maybe he can't eat from them because God's given them to somebody else. He's got them, but it's just passing through his hands, and he doesn't enjoy them. And then there's the other kind of person that God blesses, and he enjoys it. Well, which category do you want to be in? I think, obviously, it's a no-brainer. All right, well, our time is up, so we will stop there today and continue. We'll be ready to dive into this fresh on Wednesday about the mismanagement of wealth. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.